Blog Talk Radio.
To Heart Talk with Miss E. If you're a true follower, this is probably the second time you've heard my voice today. But hopefully it has not been something that you regretted. Here at Heart Talk with Miss E, we talk about matters of the heart and things that are pertaining to the lives of our young people, from our children, youth, adults, and our young adults who are former foster children. And this morning, you got to hear Ms. Kim Burnell-Smith, who is the founder of Heart to Heart Communication. And we know that was just a real wonderful heart connection between us. And we hope that you will look at our archives and take a listen at that. This evening, we have a guest who we've been talking about doing this for quite some time now. And I thought today would be a very appropriate time, considering the topic of our conversation week before last, in which we talked about the impact of mental health and mental illness in the African-American community. And our guests then were Ms. Terry Williams, who is the author of Black Pain, It Just Looks Like We're Not Hurting, and Ms. Cheryl Mims, who is a doctoral candidate who's writing her dissertation on the impact of children caring for their caregivers. So, but because they are doing their work and their research in that area, we focused on that population. However, we know that any matters of the heart, of the mind, anything that happens on the inside of us is a universal issue. And our guest today is someone who can speak to that from a slightly different perspective, because Cheryl did not go through the foster care system, and she was in a position of caring for her mom pretty much on her own with her two siblings without ever having any intervention. So she was able to maintain a sense of family, but there we know that there were a lot of missing links there. So our guest this evening is Mr. Tom Perry. And Tom was born to biological parents who were both diagnosed with a mental illness. He entered foster care at the age of 8, experienced 7 placements until he aged out at the age of 18. And as Tom will share with you this evening, that in looking back on his childhood, he sees a mixture of both setbacks and successes. He has graduated from college, served as a volunteer missionary, and is fluent in 3 languages. However, he says all he's ever wanted to do since he was 10 was come back home where he belongs. Today, Tom is a budding entrepreneur and says he loves being home where he belongs, and he's taking care of his mom, who he believes is much happier today than she has been for decades. Tom, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you here and so glad that you're willing to share your story, because there are a lot of people who share your experience, but because of various reasons, you know, a lot of it being shame, a lot of it still being feeling confused and a lot of mixed emotions, choose not to share their story. So I appreciate your having the heart and having the courage to share this. But it sounds like you have been able to take and look at the whole situation and really create an understanding of the whole big picture And so I hope that that's what our listeners will get from this today.
Well,
so tell us about your life before you entered foster care.
Well, life before I entered foster care, I was raised with my mother and father till he passed away in 1977. I was four. And my mom struggled as a single mom, did the best she could to take care of me and a little baby sister that came along a few years later. And I enjoyed going to school. I had a lot of energy as a rowdy little kid. I was a lot taller than most of the other kids, so I kind of stood out. And I stood out for other reasons, too. I just hadn't developed a lot of social skills. I was just a little too rowdy. And those were due to things, just being overwhelming for my mom at the time. She was really suffering with grief, and we didn't have a lot of chance to take care of those hygienic things, that can be taken for granted. One day in 1982, things just kind of got overwhelming for her and fell apart. So that's where I entered into foster care.
Okay, so when you say things fell apart, what did that look like? What was that experience like for you?
Well, a snapshot of the day was she and I were walking, doing some errands, and she had just gotten so upset about she believed that she was under surveillance by a police officer, and this was a hallucination, of course, but she went to the police station and complained about it. They took her into another room, and my little sister, who was an infant at the time as well, and talked with her there, kind of an interview and finding out exactly what's going on so they can understand, and came in and asked me a few things too. And at this point, I knew my mom had some problems. I used to have dreams about her being two different people.
Mm.
But in talking to the police and answering their questions, I was on my mom's side, of course. I think I said something like, she's not going to bite you. Little 10-year-old kid saying this stuff. So the officer said, your mom's got some problems, and we need to get you some help.
Mm.
I saw her in handcuffs with her hands behind her back, and we were being led to the squad car, and they put handcuffs on me.
Oh, my gosh.
They drove us to a hospital. I remember just things were really quiet in the back of the squad car.
Were you and your sister in the car together?
Yeah. We were all together at this point.
Okay.
I asked if they could put the handcuffs in front, and they allowed us to do that, for me. They walked us to a building. I don't remember where it is, but it was some kind of a psychiatric facility. The receptionist was behind bars and asked the officers if we had given them any trouble. They took us into some rooms, and again, there were some interviews, and I felt I could trust the interviewer because he, spoke as if, hey, if these things are really happening to your mom, if somebody's putting her under surveillance and, doing these harmful things, then we got to do something. So I thought, okay, well, yeah, I can be candid with this guy, and I told him I didn't know, I didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
So from that day on, we were separated, and I went to the San Jose Children's Shelter for a few days, where they kind of decide what to do with a lot of kids there. Some kids are there long term. I was only there a few days, where they give you a medical checkup and a lot of bunk beds there, a big facility with big rooms where a whole lot of kids are sleeping in the same room. And then I was placed in a satellite home, is what they call it. It was a little ranch, and it's up on a hill run by a mom and pop who had brought in a lot of kids during their time. And I actually have good memories from there.
So that was your initial placement after the shelter. So when your mom was having, you know, the delusional thinking and what you know now was, you know, part of the paranoia, had she received any mental health services prior to that? Had she been diagnosed as having any problems before that?
Yeah. She had some nervous breakdowns, and understandably so. You know, things had just really fallen apart so badly. She was really grieving over my father's death, which was a suicide. And she just had a lot of adversity throughout her life since childhood herself. A lot of difficulty with her siblings and just poverty, being raised in Texas. And she had overcome a heck of a lot, receiving a lot of therapy in her life herself, moving out to California to try to make life better for herself. And when,
so the pressures, and we do know that stress triggers even for someone who is stabilized in a, with a mental illness, that stress can trigger psychotic episodes. And even if we think that we're functioning on a quote-unquote normal level, stress can create a lot in our bodies and really change the biochemistry in our brains, the rest of our bodies. So were the behaviors that you saw on that day, were they something new to you, or were you just kind of used to them?
No, it wasn't new. I had seen a lot of that growing up with my mom until about age 10. As I mentioned before, I would have dreams. You know, one dream that kind of recurred was I would dream that she would drive us to the grocery store and leave me waiting in our car. She would go into the store, you know, looking quite normal, just you know, neutral facial expression and such. And a different woman would come out, just in the same clothes, but with maybe like too much eyeliner around her eyes. And she was real upset and frowning. She didn't say much, but these were dreams. And I think it was just kind of my little mind communicating to me, hey, you know, something's off here. Your mom's suffering with some things. Mm-hmm. So I understood.
And actually, that was your subconscious really sort of expressing what you were experiencing, because you were experiencing her as two different people.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't, I wasn't totally insulated and shut off from what normal, you know, interaction with people is supposed to be like. I had been going to school, I was exposed to a lot of other people and their families too. So, I was coherent enough at that young age to understand something was amiss.
And I liked you said, you know, you told the officers, you know, she's not going to, what did you say, bite you or something? Because it's interesting, and part of the reason we do this call is just to inform the village. And our guest the last time stated that people just didn't really know what to make of her mom, and she basically assured people herself that, you know, she's okay, she's not, I'm not afraid of her. And I think when children go through certain things, there could be, depending on their age, some moments of fear. But then if being familiar and having that connection, there, it takes away that fear. And if we as the village could learn how to embrace those that we love and love the loved ones of other loved ones, I think it would be a more positive experience for those that we care about. So you mentioned that your mom was distraught over your father's death, and it turns out that he had died of suicide. How long, do you know how long your parents have been married?
Let's see, maybe about 5 years or so.
Okay, so yeah, that was still early in the relationship. So yeah, that was very distraughtful. Now, was there extended family anywhere around?
Well, they're out in Texas and West Virginia, and I never really knew them. I made a trip out there when I was nearing graduation from college in 1997 just to meet my mother's siblings and see kind of where I came from, you know. And I only recently discovered my father's side of the family through genealogical research, and I happen to have a cousin out there who's done a ton of it, so it's been neat to briefly get acquainted with some people. You know, I don't have communication with them every day, but it is, I mean, I didn't know people while I was growing up.
Yeah, as a child, there was no extended family to be a cushion to provide any support or extend.
No, my village was found mostly in church and my foster folks. That's where I got a lot of my strength, which helped me make it through this. You know, you were talking about mental illness earlier, and I wanted to pipe up a little bit and say it really is kind of a wild card interacting with somebody who suffers with a mental illness, schizophrenia or bipolar. It can be unpredictable. You can have varying wide, responses or behaviors. My mom, very high functioning, really, really smart, intelligent, decent individual. She's accomplished a lot, paid off the home with, just scraping by with what she had. I've heard other stories about people who suffer with much more severe situations, and it's just not pretty. I mean, I attended a support group with NAMI, N-A-M-I, National Association for the Mentally Ill. It's a support group for friends and family of the mentally ill. And, one lady's brother suffered, and he just shot their brother and father with a shotgun, So I think because of those kinds of things, people are – it is scary. There's a lot of stigma, and it can be challenging. In the case of my mom, real docile and real sweet lady to this day. She and I hug each other every day, and her affection is more precious to me than anything. And the more I get to know people and know their stories, the more I value what I have.
And that's the key, knowing people's stories. I think when we really know what a person has gone through and is going through, it gives us more compassion and more empathy. There's like you said, there is a fine line, of the boundaries and protecting them as well as protecting ourselves. But for some people, it's done in such a harsh and, for me, as I see it, is an inhumane manner. When the officer told you, that your mom had some problems, he's going to get some help, it sounded like he was really on target there, as opposed to saying just some outright rude things and being insensitive. But I don't understand why they handcuffed the children.
Well, I think I can understand that, in retrospect. As I said before, interacting with somebody who suffers in this condition, and it can be a wild card, kind of unpredictable. You don't know what's going to happen. It can be kind of scary. Me, I was already 5'9" at age 10. And over Yeah, I was a big kid.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, they kind of had to follow procedure, some kind of policy about that. I know over the years in having assistance from the police when I was away in college in another state, getting some help with maybe my mom needed, somebody to check on her, make sure she's okay or something. The police were very professional. I also know through that NAMI meeting that I mentioned before, they receive a lot of training now, sensitivity training with dealing with people who are suffering with these conditions. They have to balance this tactfulness and diplomacy and respectfulness with safety. It's nothing to take for granted.
True. This is true. So when you went into care, how long was it before you were allowed to see your mom?
Oh, it wasn't. I don't remember there being a long gap. There wasn't this looming uncertainty or unknowing what was going to happen. That was something that, I really, really loved my mom for. She would visit me faithfully every other weekend while I was growing up. It was rare that she would miss it. And I was the offender. I would flake on some of our visits sometimes. But I don't remember her, being distant or anything like that. She was doing her best to come and visit. And the system didn't, keep us apart.
Now that's good to know, because it happens so often, and especially the communication between, if there's a facility or provider of care for the parent who is suffering with the illness, and then you have the social worker and whomever else is taking care of the child, a lot of times that communication gets dropped, and that is one of the things we've tried to do at HEARTS to make sure that that does not happen, and that the child, if it's a safe situation, that the child is able to maintain contact with his or her parent, even if it's nothing but, you know, through a phone call and letter, you know, because both worry. You know, the parents worry about the kids worry about the parents. And so I think it's awesome that you were able to maintain that connection. Now, were you and your sister in the same foster home?
That ranch that I mentioned, we were there. After that, I was only there a couple months, and she was also. She was adopted into a permanent situation and raised separately from me. The policy, I guess it was there, was that, you know, she should be kind of sequestered with that family where she could grow and develop bonds and relationships. And she and I reunited later on as she got older and I was older and have kind of gotten reacquainted as adults. So now, today, we you know, we get together for a holiday or birthdays and just celebrated her little baby's first birthday. It was really nice.
Wow. And the age difference is, what, six years?
Nine years.
Okay.
She's my baby.
Does she recall
the day she was born?
Does she remember the days prior to being placed? Does she have any recall?
Oh, no. She was just an infant, you know, less than 2 years old when this separation happened. And she says she doesn't even remember a lot of things from her youth. And, you know, I don't pry or pressure her about it. I keep a lot of healthy, respectful space about those things and give her time to express those things as she wants to. And I'm just here for her. I'm her big brother.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. So you said there's a 9-year-old difference. So she was born after, because you went into care, at 10. Okay, I have my numbers. You were in care for 8 years, and I'm thinking you went into care at the age of 8. Okay, I will continue and read my notes carefully. Oh, wow. So tell us about, do you remember anything about your dad?
Yeah, sure I do. You know, as a 4-year-old and earlier than that, I do have a few images of him. I remember him wearing really thick kind of tortoise shell glasses that you typically see in the 60s and 70s. You know, a lot of men wore those. I remember being in the car with him, and his hands were just these thick, strong limbs of their own. Each finger was just this super strong. Digit, you know. His fingernails were ridged like clamshells. I mean, the guy just seemed like this tower to a little boy. I remember he would take us to an amusement park quite a bit, me and my mom, and I have good memories of that, and it was really nice. And those are just a few snapshots. I remember being in the car, taking the glasses off of his face and putting them on my own, and I remember asking him, hey, what are those red lights on the back of the cars in front of us mean? And he said, they mean, don't hit me. So, you know, those are a few little images I have of him.
Okay.
Later on, you know, as I kind of grew up and was able to understand people, you know, my mom would share with me that he was very intelligent and very, very honest and sincere, really talented guy. I have one of his drawings here on my wall. It's some kind of a mechanical part that looks like it was drawn by a machine, but he did it by hand.
Oh, wow.
Really, you know, my folks said he was some kind of a genius. With further maturity, you know, I could see kind of the whole story of how his life came and went. He had a lot of tragedy in his life, a lot of suffering. He suffered with manic depression, bipolar disease, and... you know, I don't know everything about what happened in his youth. I know he had a strained relationship with his brother, his parents, my grandparents. Loved them both. I have some good photographs of them, and, you know, I tried to provide a good good upbringing for him. But I think his father, my grandfather, was away in the Navy for 12 years on a submarine, and just couldn't always be there. My mom characterized him as kind of a poor little rich kid. He was in Virginia, and yeah, he suffered a lot of injuries. He drove a Porsche off a cliff when he was 16. He wanted to be a mechanical engineer. He studied at UCLA for a few years. He was trying to graduate in 3 years because he couldn't do it in four. He had to hurry up and finish because his father had a heart attack and couldn't pay his tuition. And so he really strained himself trying to stay up all night and study with a mechanical engineering degree. That's no small feat. And things just didn't work out. He didn't get to finish. He met my mother, and was in church. They held hands and went to the beach and decided to get engaged all on day one.
Wow.
Yeah, so a few months later, they were married, and about a year later, I came along. As an adult, in the late 90s, I had a heated conversation with my mom, and it was hard for her, and she turned up missing. So I was out in Utah, and I called my mom to find out, if she was okay, and I called several times that day, and she was gone, not answering the phone up, into 10 o'clock at night. So I called the police to do a welfare check and ask, if she was there, and they did. They picked the lock and went in there, and she wasn't there. And that's not my mom. She's on a routine. She's home every night and up early in the morning. So I flew out from Utah to come look for my mom, and in looking through the house and, looking through the documents and everything while she wasn't there, I saw my father's death certificate. And it was then, when I was in my 20s, that I learned that he died of a suicide.
So they did not tell you that?
No. My mother protected me from that.
Wow.
I thought he had died of drinking and smoking excessively, which I can see now that he did as a self-medication. I saw a picture of him with some black circles under his eyes, and I think his liver was just shot. Yeah, but he drank like a fish and smoked really a lot too. And I think it was to deal with all this heartbreak and pain that he had in his life.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's something people don't understand, is that a lot of times when people are being provided treatment, they're needing to receive treatment as a dual diagnosis through some type of addiction that they're using to try to self-medicate, to try to find that place of balance and comfort, and at the same time, with the biochemical imbalance that's going on.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Those things can reinforce each other.
So that must have been very difficult to find that out, and especially at that moment when you're not knowing what's going on with your mom.
Yeah, it was, I think it was a life changer for me. I think I was old enough to have the fortitude to handle it, and I still shed a few tears to this day. I saw the movies Thor and Tron, and those have father-son elements in there, separation and reunion, and I cried like a baby.
Mm-hmm. And the tears are healing. They're healing.
Yeah.
Wow. So when did your mom reappear?
We found her about a week later because of confidentiality laws. The hospital where she was couldn't tell me she was there, even though I'm her son and such. I called all over the place. I looked everywhere. I printed up a little, missing persons sign with her picture. Call Tom at this number, and could ask the whole area. And my foster dad, with whom I'm still in touch, just happened to have connections with the San Jose Police Department. He was a firefighter, retired as a battalion chief, and he says, "Hey, my son's looking for his mom." And so during a shift change, they held up the sign and says, "Hey, if you find this lady, call Tom at this number." So one officer held his hand up and says, "Hey, I picked her up downtown. She was real upset, and I took her to the hospital." So that's how we found out where she was after about a week. And, you know, I was ready to abandon my schooling in Utah and just pick up my life back here in California looking for my mom, however long it took. Thankfully, I was able to find her at the Valley Medical Center. And I was never so happy to see anybody in my life.
I can imagine.
Yeah, and she was too. You know, she had written a letter to me that wouldn't have arrived till 3 days after our phone conversation, and you know, I would have been flipping out at the time. So I just couldn't wait. I just dropped everything and flew out there with what little cash I had, and was just so glad to find her. She thought that maybe I didn't care, or you know, I wouldn't come find her. But she was so glad to see that I did.
Wow. So if I understood correctly, you said that the two of you had an argument on the phone prior to this?
Oh, yeah. We were resolving a lot of emotional issues.
Okay.
You know, I had a lot of anger about things in my childhood, too.
Did the two of you ever do therapy together?
No. We were separated a lot while I was growing up. I had some therapy while I was in foster care on rare occasions, but not that much. My mom would go to court mostly. That was her interaction with the system for the most part. And she's been to psychiatrists and never a lot of medication until recent years. And that's been, you know, that's had its ups and downs too.
She had not been on medication until recent years?
Correct. Yeah, she's just recently started. Within the last 10 years, she started getting on medication.
Now, I find that quite interesting. So what were they doing when they had her hospitalized, an inpatient? They weren't stabilizing her with medication?
Was she just not compliant
when they released her?
Yeah, that episode, that week, you know, where I went to find her, I went back to school in Utah, but they got her stabilized on some medication from that point on. The combination, I think she was on Stilazine and Cogentin, it was just having a lot of really unpleasant side effects. It would dry her mouth and eyes out and make her really sleepy, and she just didn't like it. And you know, I wasn't there for her sessions with her psychiatrist, but yeah, I think she was getting more and more upset. She would be up in the middle of the night screaming and upset about a lot of things still. So she quit taking.
Was she living alone?
What's that?
Was she living alone?
Yeah, she was living alone while I was away in school, and I came back in 1999 to come home and hold down the fort, help out however I can, and to heal myself too.
And I'm so glad to hear that, you know, you became active in NAMI, because I think that's one of the best ways to be able to get support from people who understand what you're going through, and there's just not someone giving you their theoretical perception and advice. But you were saying that you didn't do any therapy together, and I'm wondering, do you think it would have made any difference at all, would it have had any impact as a child, if you had been able to go to therapy with your mom? I'm assuming you had your own individual therapy as a child, right?
No. When I was a kid up till the time I went into foster care, there just weren't very many resources. We were just struggling to run our lives the best we could. She ran a little graphic business.
While you were in care?
While I was in care, there were the standard intake type of assessment situations. And I do remember one psychologist talking with me when I was about 11, giving me the Rorschach test, you know, the ink blots and such. And talked a little bit about that on our online forum. But not too much therapy other than that. I mean, church was a huge, huge therapeutic influence for me. That was a sustainer of my sanity, what I could cultivate. So I got a lot out of that. And I think my coping resource was obedience. And when I was growing up, I was just in shock. I was in so much shock. I just didn't know how life was supposed to be. I didn't know how family was supposed to be. And what it's supposed to be mean anyway. It's so relative that it's hard for anyone to understand, much less a kid who's going through that.
Right.
So I just resorted to the basic pain-pleasure principle, avoid pain and seek after pleasure, and mostly avoiding the pain of disapproval of authority figures, because everybody was such an authority figure to me. You had the foster parents, you had the social workers, and everybody around me. So do not displease authority. I just tried to do well in school. I tried to go to church and be real, real responsible and a good boy. And I got a lot of reward out of that. You know, I got some praise out of that.
It's
so that was kind of the way
The stereotype is of the child who's acting out. And, you know, going against authority and rebelling, et cetera. But there are, you know, there is a percentage of people who do the opposite. I'm just curious to know, though, what was your, you know, like you were saying, you know, that fear or the avoidance of disappointment. What did you picture in your mind would happen if someone was disappointed with you?
Well, I was afraid I would get just kicked back out into the children's shelter. And the whole uncertainty of it was scary to me.
Okay.
You know, I wanted to grow some roots and bloom where I was planted. In one home.
So you were in 7 placements, and I'm wondering, what was the longest period of time you were in any one home?
4 years.
4 years. Okay.
Yeah. From about age 14 till I aged out.
Okay, so that was the longest one was the last one.
Yeah. Okay. I was there about 4 years. It was intended to be a permanent placement. I'm still in touch with a lot of my foster folks. I have affectionate relationships with them. There's a mixture of with anybody. You know, a lot of people have dysfunction in their homes, and I did too.
Mm-hmm.
But I am grateful for the good things that I have in my life, too. I've got 2 or 3 moms, you know. And I have a foster dad I love very much. And there were some painful times while I was growing up with lots of, you know, a lot of foster kids. The plight of the foster kid is inequity, and blood is thicker than water, you know. You can go on and on with all the things that can go wrong taking care of a kid who's not your own.
Right. What were the circumstances of your being moved from those different places?
Well, the ranch, the first place, was intended to be temporary until they find a long-term situation.
Mm-hmm.
The next place I went was a longer-term group home, where they allow more time for the courts to decide whether a kid should be reunited with their natural family or a permanent placement should be found. And I remember kind of enjoying being there. You know, I was in 6th grade and making friends, and just re-found some of them on Facebook recently.
Mm.
And one day I came home after about a year of living there. I kind of got adjusted and started to fit in, and the lady who was the house parent there said, "Well, good news, Tom, your social worker found you a family." I was stunned. I was stopped in my tracks. Like, oh, yeah, that's why I'm here. I was going to live in Santa Cruz for the rest of my youth, you know. I met this family who came to visit, driving a yellow Mercedes-Benz, and I was just stunned by them, too. They were so... They were beautiful. They were so. It's like they shone from, like they descended from heaven. I was so shy. They took us all out to eat at a restaurant, and I didn't eat anything. Everybody else ordered, ate food. I thought, well, I'm going to be such a good boy that you don't even have to feed me. I didn't want to impose. I was too polite. I know this is a contrast to a lot of situations with kids. A lot of kids do act out and are real rebellious. And this was just my experience. I was in shock a lot of the time.
Right. But it's even important because we do have the children who are withdrawn, and people look and say, I don't understand it. It's almost like some people are never pleased. It's like you're either too loud or too rowdy or too quiet and withdrawn. But everyone processes things in a different way, and that's the whole purpose for being able to talk, because now we're looking at what was actually going on, in your mind. It's like not wanting to be a burden to anyone.
Yep, that's exactly what it was. Sometimes I wish I had the gall or the spine to rebel and stand up for myself in some ways. Mm-hmm. I just got by the best I could.
Oh. So how long were you in that home?
Well, I lived with them for about a year. I bonded with them. I still call them mom and dad today. I'm in touch with a couple of their kids. Real good people. I didn't get along with their son, and also, there was something told to the social worker about one of the older daughter. She wasn't comfortable around me. I think that I read the social worker's report. It said something about how quiet I was, and that could possibly hide aggression.
Oh, please.
I came home from the seventh grade one day and found my belongings in some grocery bags. Looked at me with those beautiful green eyes, and a social worker was on the way to pick me up. And I was in shock, but I was, heartbroken enough to, I was heartbroken about it. And they were too, we all cried about that. She had found me in an article in the newspaper called Kids Who Wait. Given a name, Douglas, and they did a little blurb about me. I was a wrestler and active in I was a real healthy kid and looking for a home, and she just felt something special, like she should bring me into the home, and that was I really liked that. I really like how she shared that with me. And they've shared beautiful things with me over the years. I've gained so much wisdom and goodness, through their influence, even though things didn't work out back then.
Right. But you maintained a relationship. Ceases to amaze me, and it still always angers me that people don't talk. I mean, it's I don't understand it. Even people who get married and divorced, generally, there is some type of dialogue that takes place that gives them the indication, okay, this is coming to an end. How can you just take someone's belongings and just put them, out or by the door and say, okay, you're leaving here? I just have a difficult time with that, and I experienced that recently with the case, when I was the therapist's son. And I was really working hard with this family to get them to really understand what was going on, with the siblings. And I got a call from the social worker saying they wouldn't be coming to therapy because they were being picked up. And could I help them? I just have issues with that. So somebody's going to have to help me with that so I can help somebody else. Because I was furious for days on end. And every time I hear something like that, to me, it would just be plain and simple. And they're making assumptions about your behavior. Nobody's talking to you. No one's asking you any questions. No one is giving you an opportunity to express your feelings. What were you supposed to do?
Sure. Well, it's hard for people when a decision is made that affects them and they're not involved in the decision. I was 12 at the time, so how much involvement can I have? With my situation, there were some, unsavory things going on with their son, their natural son, and it wasn't healthy. It couldn't keep going. He had his own issues. He died young. He was only 27. He choked on some food by himself. So, you know, it's a real sensitive area, and you know, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I love these people, and they're my family. But things don't always work out in these placements. They just don't. I mean, there's many, many stories. What I got out of it is more precious than just about almost anything, is I still have an affectionate relationship with these people. And I was introduced to church, you know, when I came to them. My mom had already taught me about God and everything, and I believed that he was a father for me when my father had died. And when I was there in the living room listening to missionaries who told me about God answering prayers, you know, maybe he would answer my prayers, even though I'm just a, you know, little 12-year-old kid. You know, and I everything they told me just made so much sense. It made so much sense, it felt as if I was remembering it from somewhere, even though I'd never heard it before. And, you know, just the decision to believe and to trust that God created me and that he doesn't make junk, and it wasn't just an accident or a waste. That purpose or some reason that's helped sustain me. And there's been plenty of challenge to that, plenty of reason not to believe. The conclusion I've come through after, you know, going to college, studying psychology at a religious university, BYU, you know, my conclusion is that you cannot prove or disprove whether God is there or whether he loves you. It's a decision to believe or not to believe. As long as I've continued to choose to believe, I've been sustained. I'm okay.
Yes. And it's beautiful that you were able to grasp that and to be able to use that pretty much as a barometer of your life. And you're also your telescope for life, looking forward, looking into the future and saying there is more for me,
sure,
that situation.
Sure.
And that was actually one of the questions I was going to ask. What was it that got you through, you know, all of these changes and, you know, the circumstances and really holding on to be able to know, as you said, that you were going to be back home where you belonged?
Yeah. Well, yeah. When back in that long-term group home, the house parent, the man there sat me down when I was about 11 and asked me, okay, Tom, what do you want to do with your life? And just right off the bat, I just spoke from the heart. I said, I want to come home and take care of my mom.
Mm.
And he got mad. He got mad at me. He says, she's not your girlfriend. You do that with a girlfriend and you make her your wife. You don't take care of your mom like that. And then his wife says, you know, we had another girl come through here, and she's grown up, and she's gone off to take care of her mom, and, you know, that's not entirely new to us, you know. So that, at the time, still I was in shock, you know. I didn't understand how confusing that was. Wait a minute, one of you says that's not okay, and the other one says, hey, that's okay. So it's just, you know, been kind of a duality, like, what's up with this? So
I think coming from, you know, the professional community, the clinical team, is not wanting a child to be what we call the parentified child, feeling that you deserve to have a childhood yourself, and you can't do that if you are taking care of an adult. You're missing out on certain developmental stages of your life. So I think for you saying, you know, that was what your long-term goal is, and even as we were preparing for this and we came up with the title, or as I came up with the title, because I didn't really ask you how you felt about it until after the fact, but, you know, based on the sign, you know, I am my brother's keeper, you're your mother's keeper. But I think there's a point in life where those of us who have had or do have parents or parent figures to be able to give back to them. And I believe in being a caretaker and a caregiver for anyone, we should also make sure that there's balance in getting our own needs met.
Sure.
So,
yeah, it's entirely natural to be a kid, to grow up. You know, your parent kind of sustains you and helps you out when you're a kid. And later on, when the kid becomes an adult, yeah, I give back and help the parent out. I'll never make excuses for myself. You know, I just try to make plans for success. But my situation was, when I was growing up, as a teenager, I still have an affectionate relationship with, one of my brothers from this home. But 6 months after I came to live there, the father comes in and announces, we're getting a divorce.
Mm.
So there was stunned silence. It seemed like forever in the living room at that time. And the father asked each one of the boys and me, what do you think of that? They just started shedding tears. The tears just gushed. These young men were just stunned and devastated by it. And I didn't know, the reality of it didn't hit me. But from then on, there was so much screaming and yelling in the home, for another 4 years.
Okay.
And I came out of there feeling that it was a huge crime to be male. All the guys around here, all men are just lecherous jerks, and everybody's like the ex-husband. And so that was kind of my that was ingrained into me. I just felt bad.
They separated, and this was coming from the mom.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And, that's not to demonize her. She had her own trials and her own plight, her own story, of how things went so bad when she was a kid.
Right. But, and I hear you have a lot of mercy, you have a lot of grace, and I believe that's God-given. God giveth more grace than he gives us the ability to have that. At the same time, in advocating for our children, it's like I stated in another conversation I had with someone, that when you're looking at people in the child services, in the field of child services, you often have two camps of people. You have the people who are pro-child, and the child could do no wrong, and the parents are all wrong. And then you have the pro-parents, who their parents are right and the children are little demons. Very few people really look at the family setting as a whole and look at what are the strengths and what are the areas of growth for both sides.
Yeah.
So, when we're looking at that, it's not to demonize the mom, but in her pain, her hurt added on to yours. As they say, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Someone needed to be able to protect you from that. Actually, she probably needed to be protected from herself, as we all do at times.
Sure.
I think we all have those seasons in our lives where we are just really not in a space where we're really good models for other people, but hopefully we take care of ourselves and become healthier as we go along. The other part of that is that I lost my train of thought.
Sure.
Sometimes I guess we just... pause. We just need to pause and really see what's going on. But someone needed to be able to come in and intervene and to say, okay, this is what's going on. Not to try to isolate you from real life, because that is real life, but to be able to say, you're hurting here, and this is what's coming off with the children. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. Well, so, a common theme with a lot of kids in foster care, I think, okay, is that the objective is to get them up till they're 18. And the expediency of the situation, sweeps a lot of this stuff under the rug. A lot of kids fall through the cracks with their emotional needs. We take care of a lot of the physical needs, the food, clothing, and shelter. But they need not just those things. They need the emotional things. They need both the milk and the honey. Milk being all the physical stuff, that we kind of pay for, food, clothing, and shelter. And they need the sweetness of life, too. Kids need joy of being a little boy or a little girl. They need, a happy perspective on the world. I understand that there are a lot of damage that happens, and that's part of it. But we have to overcome that somehow. My coping was to be real obedient, and I didn't stand up for myself, and I think that's manifested into my adulthood. I've kind of sequestered myself and never really reached out a lot. And now that I've put first things first, I've come home, take care of my mom, take care of myself, to heal all this stuff. You know, I repressed a lot of those angry feelings that would manifest themselves in acting out. I just held all that in, and it manifests itself in depression or, you know, self-medication type things. You know, I would resort to a lot of retail therapy. I've wasted so much money just buying little toys and things like that to try and feel better. And it just needs to get talked out. I mean, human connection has been the best medicine for me ever. I love our little online community of, Foster Care Alumni of America. Derek Clark is a huge hero to me. Our bunch of rascals, Nikki and everybody, you know, this has been one of the best things to ever happen to me. Finding you, Mizzy, I mean, my gosh. I have felt relieved of just decades of feeling isolation and loneliness just from that simple human connection. Somebody you can talk to, be yourself with. I understand. They even have some similar experiences that aren't covered up, like happened so much with foster care, you know?
Yes. I just got chills when you said that, because the human connection is so important, but a nurturing connection. And you talk about, you know, the honey and the milk, and that's really the concept of heart. It's for a child's heart, and as I've stated before, you have some parents who are just caregivers who are just totally, you know, neglectful and abandoned, you know, rejecting everything. And then you have those
again,
who
let me say, that's the plight of the foster kid, okay?
Mm-hmm.
These kids need this affection and love, but it's so regulated that, I mean, it's unsafe or you can't do that. And so they starve. They miss out on these things that are so crucial to their well-being.
I missed something. I'm sorry. You said that they can't do that. Who can't do what?
Well, relationships with these kids are just so regulated. They have to be because of all the long history of bad things that have happened, you know. And so it becomes so clinical and sterile. These kids, you know, everybody needs love and affection. It's just natural. It's like water growing flowers and plants. And the kids miss out on that because, you're not supposed to bond with foster kids. They're only going to be here for a short time. Or this kid's got too many problems. You can't love them. You know, things like that. And it's understandable why it happens. I'm not casting judgment. You know, I'm a merciful guy, like you said. But this is what everybody needs. We need to be loved and we need to be cared about. We need that village like you advocate.
Dude, that is just so foreign to me. I just don't get that. And I think because I came here being what people tease me and say, you know, I was born into the world looking for a love fest. And I just can't see someone not being willing to give a child a hug or, you know, and I know some kids are really shy, you know, about even being touched because of their experiences, but I always have to touch a child, you know, to either give me a high five, let me rub your head, let me tap you on the shoulder or your back or something, because that human connection is so important. So when I hear that, it's like, it makes me want to curse and say, who in the ever came up with that kind of philosophy of child rearing? It's like, you know, we're supposed to be fostering love. We're supposed to be fostering a sense of acceptance and belonging. And I just don't get that. And someone asked me recently, did I ever choose to do something different than what I was told to do as a foster parent with my children? Every child that came in my home, you know, became my child, which actually became issues with sometimes. But I could never see that. So I just get angry, as you could tell, just hearing that. Someone would say, you know, well, that's, you know, the way you're supposed to treat them. They're not animals. You know, animals get better treatment than that sometimes.
Yeah.
So I just, yeah, let me calm myself down. We have people that are eager to come in on the line. I just want to ask you another thing, though, about you're taking care of your mom now, and it was just really just heart-touching for me to hear you say that she is the happiest you've seen her in the past decade. You know, she's been happier in the past decade than before.
Yeah, I think some time and that human connection between me and my mom has done wonders for her and for me, too, for both of us. I love to see my mom laugh and smile. That's so rewarding, you know. That makes me feel like, okay, hey, you know, maybe maybe what I'm doing here is okay. And I didn't even think that. It's just natural. That's just what flowed from my heart. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. I've had a lot of conflict. I've wept bitterly over feeling that I failed to meet expectations of people around me. Oh, I'm supposed to be married. I'm supposed to have kids now. I'm supposed to be pursuing some career and be an executive at a huge corporation or something like that. But I put first things first. This is where I'm supposed to be.
I believe we all have a journey. We all have a purpose to fulfill. And sometimes I believe that we came here into the world through the wombs that we came through for a particular purpose, whether it was to give them something or to give something to someone else when we're separated from them. You know, Khalil Gibran said, our children come through us, not from us. And so I believe that you know within your heart of hearts what your purpose and what your role is. And when that starts to feel like it's in conflict, you will know, and especially through your faith and your trusting God. You know, and I, you know, believe in Scripture, and it says the steps of a righteous man are ordered of God. And it doesn't mean necessarily righteous, you know, about being self-righteous, but it means seeking the truth, someone who is seeking the truth and to walk in a way that is of integrity. And I believe, just from what I know of you, that that is what you're doing. So I'm just really so pleased, and this hour has flown by here. I actually had a couple of other questions I wanted to ask you, but I'm going to go ahead and let our listening audience, and I see we have people in the guest room, we have people on the call-in line. So are you prepared to talk to someone other than me? Hold on. Let me get back to the right screen. Oh, I guess we talked so much. A couple of people hung up, but we still have a few. So I'm going to start with area code 732. Are you on the line?
Hi. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, I wanted to ask, hello?
Hi, go ahead. Who's calling?
Yes, I wanted to ask Tom about, like he said, his sister was adopted. Was he placed for adoption?
No,
hello?
It was decided that, I was much older than my sister. She was this little baby. So, yeah, I was quote unquote too old, and I didn't really want to be adopted. That issue had come across, and yeah, I didn't want to change my last name. I still had a real a bond with my mom, and so I was active in the decision to not adopt me, and I wasn't too happy back then where I was, so no, I didn't want to be stuck.
Did you have any other questions?
No, I think he's doing a great job, and I admire that he's very resilient.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Area code 989.
Hello. Can you guys hear me?
Hello.
Hi, this is Nikki. Hey. I just wanted to call in and say hi to my people, to my brother Tommy. I just wanted to show you my love and support, you know, as my brother. Almost all of us rascals are here to support you. And I just wanted to say that Tommy is the most genuine, loving, compassionate guy I have known. And he is such an inspiration, I know, to me and others. And just hearing you, Tom, just, you know, telling your story and being so open with the world, it just kind of gives me hope that one day that I'll be able to do that. So I just wanted to thank you and just say I love you. I love you like a brother. And keep doing your thing, brother.
Thanks, Nikki. Nikki has become my sister within the last few months through, you know, meeting up on our little support group on Facebook, our bunch of rascals. One of the best things that ever happened to me. She's been the leader in creating that group, and she's wonderful herself. And she is like a sister to me.
Aww.
And Nikki is practicing public speaking, so she is going to be impacting and blessing lives.
She already is. So she's an excellent writer. She's an excellent coordinator. But
listen to our voicemail. We know she's an excellent speaker too. So we're just that's what we're going to do. We're going to support one another until we get rolling. So if she's your sister, then that makes you my son because for her birthday she became my daughter.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. I inherited a new mom on my birthday.
So there. So we're all family. Wonderful. Thank you for being on the call, and you're coming soon. We know that, right?
What's that?
Miss Nikki?
Oh, what?
I said, you're coming on soon. You know that, right?
Oh, I am?
Yes, you are.
Okay, you're going to
you're
have
well
to
on your way. But thank you for being just
okay, love you guys.
Love you, too, and thank you for being just such a great support.
Oh, thanks. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye, Nikki.
And, oh, she hung up. Okay. And I know who this next person is. I think it's somebody that you're going to be very excited to hear from. Is this the D-Man? Hello?
Hello?
Hey, talk to me.
Oh, you there?
Yeah, are you there?
I didn't even call in. I thought there was a whole other line to call in. I'm sorry. Oh.
Don't be sorry.
Okay.
Surprise!
Yeah, surprise, Tom, brother. Diamond D in the house here.
Sure.
Hey, big shout out to you and Lucy and Missy and Nikki T and all of our brothers and sisters out there. I just wanted to say, man, you know, when I met you a year ago when you called me, the day before Thanksgiving, and I spent a few hours on the phone with you, and I saw you in your vulnerable state, basically, and how we shared a bunch of things. And I got to tell you, brother, in front of the whole audience here, in front of the world, man, I have seen you grow leaps and bounds and take the Tom back, the Tom that was 19 years old, 20 years old, Elder Tom, right, and take him back and say, man, I have faith again, I have power again. I can change the direction of my life. I can take responsibility, and I have nothing can stop me, and I've seen that. And I've seen your compassion. I've seen your humility, and I'm really proud of you, brother.
Hey, thanks a lot, Derek. Meeting you lit the fuse. You know, it was a miracle. I just was so withdrawn and just held back so much. I hid myself away in just pain and loneliness. And finding you just gave me permission to connect.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the only
one
who's
like that's the one thing. I think that's the one thing that holds a lot of people back is saying you are good enough, you know, to give yourself permission and say, you know what? I have the DNA of God inside of me. I can become anything I want to become. I can be anything I want to be. You know, so I saw that, dude, over the last, at least, what, that was the day before November, so that's basically, you know, a little over a year and 3 or 4 months. So you have blown up, brother, like mentally and emotionally and spiritually, everything has changed about you. You're a different person, and so I'm glad our paths have crossed, and, you know, I look forward to hearing what you're going to do in the next 5 years of your life, you know.
Sure.
That's what's going to be cool, because in a matter of, you know, just in my own life, in a matter of just a year or 6 months or 2 years, bam, your life changes. Your life purpose, the direction, everything. You know, I always believe that the will exceeds the skill, and because the mind is strong, heart is strong. The will exceeds the skill. So, you know, you're a young guy. There's a lot of victory still, you know, in your future. So,
well, hey, I've got a great mentor. I've got an excellent example in you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, brother.
We got good people around us. We got a big village.
I'm actually packing and getting ready to go speak up in Washington. And I thought, well, you know what? I was just on Facebook for a few minutes. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I got to just check out what Tom's doing. So, yeah, I'm here to support you, brother.
I'm glad you did, man. Thanks, Derek.
Yeah.
We all have a lot of good things going for us. We, you know, Ms. E, like you say, we got a village of connections helping us do wonders for me.
Wow.
I just put this little heart in the chat room, this pumping, beating, and that's exactly what I'm feeling right now. It's like, okay, hold it together. But to me, this is what it's all about. This is really what it's all about, releasing what I refer to initially as that inner child and the spirit that we were born to carry out in this world. And as we touch one another, we feel it, and you know it. You know it deep down inside. And it's not about systems. It's not about theories. It's not about roles or positions. It's just about plain old love, unconditional love.
You know, one of my favorite quotes right now, because, you know, I speak to thousands and thousands of people, but I always help them to get struggle, the solution to success, the three S's, struggle, the solution to success. And I put in the chat room, hey, what does Tom want to be in the future? Where does he see himself in the future? Because I'm a big believer in hope. I'm a big believer in dreams. And I'm a big believer in the quote, you can't start the next chapter of your life if you keep rereading the last one. So I'm all about moving forward, right? And, so tell us, Tom, what do you want to be in the next 5 years? Where do you want to be? What do you want? Because you got to speak it to believe it. You got to believe it. You got to hear it. You got to speak it. When you listen back to this interview, you're going to hear what you spoke, and that is going to attract even greater things in your life because you're speaking your faith. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Well, Derek, I have kind of poked my head out from under my rock over here after a long healing process, and I've accomplished the desire to just let go of everything bad that's ever happened to me, to forgive everything, and to be full of love, and to reach out and connect to people. And that's my mission in life, to lift those hands which hang down, strengthen the knees, mourn with those who mourn, and comfort those who stand in need of comfort, to cast out the spirit of fear, and to invite that of power, and of love, and of a sound mind. And that's my mission in life. And one way or another, I'm going to do that. There could be more than one way.
Mm-hmm.
In just little ways, I've just been here at home being a handyman and a hero to my mom. I fixed a big hole in the roof and put new shingles over it and everything by myself. Now I have just been taking little baby steps. I sent an email off to volunteer at the Bill Wilson Center. I haven't heard back from them, but those kind of things. I was talking with Miss E about supporting her organization, using what talents I have with that. I want to improve my personal resources. I want to be able to bless lives however I can. Building capital, making friends and connections how I can. I want to use the voice that I have to make life better for kids in the system, for adults who were raised in the system, and for anybody and everybody who I cross paths with, I want to make.
Yeah, that sounds great. It sounds like God is directing your footsteps and causing you to be at the right, place at the right time. And I think when you said, letting go, it's so powerful, but it's so hard, right? It's so hard to let go. And kind of what helped me get through the foster care system and kind of heal was I discovered that what's happened to me with the abuse and the rejection and all that is not as important as what's happened inside of me.
Yeah.
So when you finally find value in yourself and love in yourself, that's when you can truly, truly give.
Yeah.
Right.
So
So we're just going to love it out of you. And you said 5 years, Derek. I'm excited of what's going to happen even just in the next 5 months. I can see it, I can feel it, I can hear it. So this is February, March, April, May, June, July. So look out, summer. We're going to have a whole different time coming on because he's coming out. We're going to find your theme song as well.
when I interact with you guys, it's like it magnifies. It's like a catalyst that brings all this good stuff out.
Okay.
I have talked with people, I've given advice, and then realized, wait a minute, was I giving this advice or was it, a situation where I need to take my own advice, and where is it really coming from?
Yeah,
I tell myself all the time, physician, heal thyself.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know what's even more fun is when you put it out there and then the kids that you work with turn around and tell you the same thing back and say, didn't somebody tell me that or didn't you tell me this? So I love it. So when it starts coming back at you, you know that you've gone full circle and you've completed you're in the process of completing your path.
Yep.
So it is 7:14. I did see one other question in the chat room that asked the question. I believe that was from Lucy, and I've opened up all these different screens. She wanted to know.
I always knew, even as a kid, that I would need to care for my mom.
Right, right.
Yeah, when I was little, I knew something was wrong. I would have those dreams about my mom being two different people. I didn't know exactly what that would mean and how that would play out over my life. But when I was 11, I just knew that was my response when I was asked what I was going to do with my life. I didn't even think about it. That's just what came from my mouth, from my heart. I knew I was going to do that, and that was my strongest desire. My mom was my hero. She would come and visit me just to visit me. No other motive, you know, just that natural affection that she had. It was hard to deal with when people would, you know, talk about how weird she was because of the things she was saying. When normal people, you know, it was all confusing. But that's all over now, you know. It's time to not forget that stuff because I need to be able to share that, to relate with people for real. But to forgive it all and to connect and be full of love that way.
Exactly. And I believe that the situations that we are, I want to say thrown into, but that we are surrounded by in our upbringing and any some of the challenges that we have in life are also the things which are preparing us for our life's calling. So I think the things that we learn just in everyday life are things that end up benefiting us, whichever careers we choose, that when people look at us and they say, well, how did you get that? And it's like, oh, well, it's nothing, you know, different to me because that's what I've done all the time. And I experienced that dealing with people around, you know, my sister who's developmentally disabled. And it's just real interesting hearing people's stories because they think it's just something off the wall. And it's like, this is nothing. And I talked to another young lady this weekend who said, all of her life, even when she was a child, she knew that she would be the primary care provider for her sibling. So I think we know at a young age, I think a lot of us know our callings before it gets drowned out by the cares and the madness of the world. So I believe that we're going to probably look forward to you to come back in about another 5 or 6 months. I'm almost willing to bet that we're going to hear some awesome things that have unfolded in your life because you're willing to let go. So
it'd be a pleasure. I was terrified of sharing these things. I've always been scared of being, you know, just opening myself up and sharing these things. I've been very afraid of the stigma and all these things, but I really appreciate you encouraging me.
Well, thank you. And thank you for allowing yourself to be encouraged and pushed a little bit.
Yeah.
So I'll never push you off the cliff. So with that, we're going to end our session. I want to thank the members of the Little Rascals from Facebook for being here, Ms. Nikki and Derek, Lucy, and I saw some other people that were unidentified, and I see...
Listener 10, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, this has been awesome. I look forward to it every time. And thank you for allowing us to do something special for a child's heart and doing something special for your inner child. So God bless, take care, and have a wonderful evening and week.
Good night. Thanks.
Good night.
Heavenly Mother, crying.